Good morning, and thank you very much for coming out on a Sunday morning for the topic of blood and live organ donations. I would ask that people please silence their cell phones. I recognize that when you start something at 8:45, people are walking in until 9, and so therefore there will be people who will come in who will not, have their phones on silent, but at least if the starting group has them silent, that'll be useful. We have sign-in sheets. Can someone just show me where they are at this point? Okay, there are at least some over there. If people could please sign in, especially if you would like to get CME credit, you must sign in. You can't tell me afterwards I was there. That just doesn't work. So please make sure that you sign in. And in general, if you would like to get follow-up email, including a link to the audio recording, as well as follow-up on the discussion that we have, please make sure that you sign in, because that's the way I know to send you an email. Also, if you want notice about further medical lectures in the course of the year, we have a roster lined up for the year. It's going to be a lot of fun, both here and at Shire Shemayim. So please make sure that you sign in. A few thank yous. First of all, this is actually the opening session of the Nussbaum Family Medical Ethics and Halacha Institute. The Nussbaum family having now dedicated the medical lectures that we give. So thank you very much, Dr. Nussbaum. Also, I want to thank Dr. Barry Pagus for shepherding us through the CME accreditation process. It is always a challenge, and he did it, so good news for everyone who wants CME. I do expect that my follow-up email is going to include a link to an online evaluation form for the class. Please fill it out. Even if you're not a doctor, you can still fill it out. It's important for us to get that feedback, and just skip the questions that are medical practice related. Please don't make anything up. This is also an ethics class. Two other notes before we get started. Organ donation has been a very active issue in Israel over the years, and for numerous reasons. But in particular, in the last couple of years, the religious debate on the topic has really built up. And in particular, Rav Yishai Srig wrote a book called Bochein Klayot Valev, which, of course, is a verse, but it means who examines the kidneys and the heart. That's the meaning. It's talking about God as the examiner of the kidneys and the heart. So that's what the book is called. Through a connection, he actually emailed me a PDF of it, and that was very helpful to see his material. So I'm grateful for that. And then finally, it should be obvious, but just in case it's not, nothing I say should be taken as practical guidance for an actual case. These things have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. We'll talk about that more when we get to the issue of consultation in our discussion in the, which vignette is it? It is the fourth vignette. So we'll talk more about the consultation process, but everything in this sort of arena needs to be case by case. I'm providing information, and hopefully it'll be helpful, but that's really where that ends. Okay. Everyone good so far? Haven't said anything terribly controversial yet? Good. Are there more story sheets around for those who need, or have we maxed out on... I printed a lot. Okay, no, so we still have. Okay. So, if you take a look at source number one, this takes us back to the issue of Israel and organ donation. Article that appeared in the Israel Journal of Health Policy Research last year called Israel's 2008 Organ Transplant Law Continued Ethical Challenges to the Priority Points Model. And there are parts to this law. This law was meant to combat organ trafficking. It was also meant to create incentives for organ donation. So this part in particular, take a look at source number one. The second section of the organ transplant law removes disincentives for live donation. Through multiple forms of reimbursement, live altruistic or directed donors may donate a kidney, bone marrow, or a liver splice without suffering undue financial strain. While this may have contributed to increasing rates of live organ donation in Israel, live donation has also become a popular form of charity among Orthodox Jews. The organization Matnat Chaim, Gift of Life, has facilitated 463 kidney donations since 2009, with nearly all donors identifying as Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox. The total number of live altruistic kidney donors in Israel from 2009 to 2016 was 1,032. Meaning that approximately 40% of live kidney donations in Israel since 2009 have been facilitated by Matnat Chaim. I don't know how to compare the overall number, you know, from one population to another in terms of whether 1,032 in that period of time is a lot or a little based on population size or based on need. But the point that the writer makes, I think, is very interesting to see that it's become a form of tzedakah. It's become a form of aid others has gained in popularity. I just thought that was very striking. And the question that we have to address as part of our discussion is, so what's the halacha on this? What does Jewish law actually have to say about this? So you can see on the sheet, I came up with 8 questions to address. We are not discussing all 8. I didn't even put sources on for 7 and 8 because I know we're not getting there. But I think they're good questions to think about, and that's why I left 7 and 8 on there. I would love to say we're going to get through all 6 of the first 6, and I can say that. But let's just read out 1, 2, and 3 because that's where we're going to be starting, and we're going to get as far as we can with it. And if we need to have a second session on it, then we'll add a session to the calendar in order to deal with more of these issues. So source number 1. Shira, 37, is in good physical and mental health. She learns of a need for a donated kidney for a person who is in great need of a new kidney, and she decides to get tested. She sees an email, a flyer, whatever it is. The tests show that Shira is a good candidate for donation as well as a strong match, with a high likelihood that the transplant would be successful. Is Shira religiously obligated to go through with the donation? Right? That's the most basic form of the question. You have a prospective donor who is a good match and is in good health. You have a recipient who really needs the organ. And so the question is there an obligation within Jewish law to actually go ahead with the donation? Right? Question is fairly straightforward, I hope. Okay. Second version of it adds a twist. In doing her own research to become a kidney donor, Shira learns that some studies suggest a possible future loss of a year of her life due to end-stage renal disease. How would this affect the halachic calculation for her decision? What would you think? If she learns that there's research that indicates, you know, substantive research, I don't just mean, you know, someone somewhere wrote a paper, but substantive research that indicates that it actually could be that she will suffer loss of half a year and a half of her life based on statistics for other donors. How should that, or should that at all, affect the decision?
Is that in her particular case, or is this in general?
It's a good question. I didn't think about that when I formulated this. Let's pretend for the moment that it actually seems to fit her class of donor.
So we have the factors general 10% who are likely or unlikely.
Okay. But it's very hard, given the relatively small sample size and the type of research that's been done long-term on kidney donors, it's going to be very hard to come up with percentages that you can, you know, pin this on like that.
So probably not. Anything that could harm your life.
So Leia says, you're not supposed to harm your life. Maybe at that point this becomes something. Are you suggesting that she shouldn't do it, or something that's less obligatory?
Oh, and I guess. Both. Possibly even shouldn't.
Possibly even shouldn't. The argument can be made. I think it's an interesting question, because then you have to start asking yourself, how great a risk, or what type of harm is sufficient to say now she shouldn't do this, right? Let's say that the studies showed instead of losing a year of her life that she may be on dialysis at some point.
I think it would be different.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, this is very, very different when you're looking at assisted dying. You're not allowed to shorten your life, right? And it's someone who you know is going to die, so have a 4-minute year.
Mm-hmm. So if you're not allowed to shorten your life, maybe you're not allowed to do this either. Although here, you're saving a life in the process. There was a hand down there. Yeah.
Is
Hashi.
With that kind of logic, if they give you a statistic saying women who gave birth would live a year less than if they didn't give birth, what would you say in that situation?
So that's a really good question. We engage in all sorts of activities which endanger or abbreviate life potentially. So where are you going to apply this kind of decision? It's a good question. Yosef, you were going to ask? No?
We're talking about kidney transplants. We want to talk about liver transplants or heart valve liver transplants. That's a little different. You've got people on dialysis and they can live, if they behave themselves and treat themselves appropriately, they can live 10 to 15 years on dialysis. So you're not saving a life, number one. Number two, all of these donors have excruciating pain, all of them. And the other thing is, there's a not insignificant risk of, number one, like you say, shortening their life. Number two, they could die in a perioperative period. Mm-hmm. That brings to the next question, and this is what a lot of physicians, in fact, Tom Stargell, I remember him giving a lecture. He's a liver transplant, so he passed away. Liver transplant service in Pittsburgh. And he did not transplant, he did not commit a related donor liver transplant because he said it's unethical to expose a healthy person to potential death.
Mm-hmm. So here, right, so you get a couple of points in here. Number one, surgery. All surgery involves risk. Number two, they do warn you there are elements of pain, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, for people even who donate and survive. I don't know, you're telling me it's all. That's, all's a big number, and I don't know. I know what I've read. I know the studies that I've read. But also the question of what about where the recipient is not somebody who needs it right now, but potentially in another couple of years, 5 years, whatever it is, plus the fact that I'm going to now argue the other way. From what I understand from the research I've read, and for those who don't know me and haven't been here before, I'm not a physician and I'm not pretending to be. But the studies show that somebody who has never gone on dialysis is a much better candidate for transplant and success thereafter than somebody who has gone on dialysis. So maybe you can make the argument that not to look at the possibility of dialysis and of them surviving on that, but you should do the donation in order to avoid the need for dialysis. Yes.
Can I step back to your first question?
Yeah.
Just remember that this lady voluntarily put herself forward for investigation.
Yes.
You're saying that there is an obligation on her to give. Do not say that all of us are obligated to put ourselves forward for investigation to see whether we are suitable candidates.
Mm. So that's a really good question. It's a little bit beyond the scope of where we're going to go this morning, but I will note the question because I think it's an important one for those who couldn't hear it. The question is, if there is in fact some kind of obligation to give, does that translate to an obligation to get tested to see whether you are eligible to give? Generally speaking, we do distinguish in Jewish law between somebody who knows they have the means to help and somebody who never takes that step to find out whether they have to. So, one of the first classes actually that I gave in Toronto was the question of whether there is an obligation to go to medical school in order to be able to save lives. Now that's extreme because medical school involves an awful lot. But the question can also be, is there an obligation to take CPR classes so that you'll be able to help? And while, it's universally agreed that it's a good thing to do, it's hard to argue that there's a religious obligation to actually take that step in the same way that there isn't, if you have enough money to survive, there isn't a religious obligation to go out and earn more in order to be able to give tzedakah. So it may be a good thing to do, but to argue that you're obligated to, I think is not straightforward. There was one more hand I was going to take along the wall here, but I don't know whose it was.
Yeah,
John?
I think I was just going to say that usually you don't do the transplant so far ahead. Usually you try to get the most you can out of the kidneys for the last bit.
Why is that?
Because because you're capable of treating chronic kidney disease very late into the process to maintain the function of the care.
And also you don't know how the new kidney is going to function and possibly the disease that which the first kidney could recur in the transplant.
And all the complications that arise from the transplant.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more as we go through it. I'm just going to read the third of the questions, and then we're going to move into the substance that we have here. Richard, 37, is in good physical and mental health. His synagogue is holding a blood drive. He has never given blood. In doing his research, Richard learns that blood donation is considered extremely safe, and the blood is used for patients in great need of transfusion. Those are givens for the scenario that I'm creating here. Is Richard obligated to donate blood? And to smooth the discussion, I'll just explain the reason why I give this is not just because the title of the class is Blood and Live Organ Donation, but also because, generally speaking, it is understood that it is a safer thing to do. And therefore you take out some of the risk element and certainly some of the pain element. As someone who gives as regularly as I can tell you it's relatively painless to do. So how does that affect the decision process? So let's talk about the core issue. And the core issue involved, and we'll get to as many of the other questions as we can, but this starts us off. The core issue really seems to be the question of undergoing harm, real harm or harm, potential harm, both apply, in order to aid somebody else. The most extreme form of harm is danger to life. Organ donation, certainly kidney donation, was considered very dangerous at the outset, with a very low chance of success in terms of the take on the transplant. And so the original responsa that discussed kidney transplant said absolutely not. If you go back, I'm talking about the 50 years ago, they were not willing to permit it. As they said, it's too dangerous for the donor, and you're you're likely not going to extend the life of the recipient. Beyond the scope of our discussion this morning is the ethical question of, yes, but practice with this will enable more success later on, as in fact happened. That's not our discussion this morning, but it's a worthwhile question to ask. If you take a look at source number 2 on the sheet, and below the questions, from the website of the Kidney Foundation of Canada, they talk about the safety and success rates today. In the short term, we'll talk about long term later. Short-term physical risks. These risks are related to the surgery to remove the kidney and are common to any kind of major surgery. First one, mortality, also known as death. Extremely rare, about 3 people for every 10,000 surgeries. Okay. Major complications may include allergic reaction to anesthesia, collapsed lung, blood clots. Minor complications may include pneumonia, infection, pain, and discomfort. So, go back to the pain item from before. Apparently, we now view that as a minor complication. There are other issues, of course, that come up. Time lost from work, family issues that may come up, including family being uncomfortable with the actual donation. Those are things to consider. But it's clear that there is a substantive risk to life. Even if you'll tell me, well, it's only 3 in 10,000, that's still a number. And this person was 0 in 10,000, obviously everyone is at some risk, but that they're entering into a situation in which they're now in this 3 in 10,000 category, and that really can't be ignored. On the Jewish law side of things, when you flip the page, you see source number 3. In all of the sources, I brought you the original Hebrew as well as my translation, but for time reasons, I'm going to read out only the English aloud, and you can see the original Hebrew as well. The Talmud writes, "One may not harm himself. But if he does so, he's exempt from liability. We're not going to make you pay yourself. And we're not going to lash you for having hurt yourself. However, you're not allowed to cause yourself physical harm. Others who harm a person are indeed liable. One is not allowed to harm oneself. One is also not allowed to enter into risk to one's own life." If you take a look at source number 4, Maimonides writes it. There's some debate as to what his Talmudic source is. Nonetheless, it's accepted as law. So too, there is a commandment to remove any stumbling block which endangers lives, and to guard from it, and to be very careful with this. And he quotes you a verse, a pasuk from Devarim, from Deuteronomy, guard yourself and guard your life. And if one does not remove it, and one leaves dangerous stumbling blocks in place, he fails to fulfill a commandment, and he violates the law. Do not place blood in your house. You're not allowed to create danger to any life, including your own. So here you have a basic problem. Because kidney.ca is telling me 3 in 10,000 for mortality, standard risks involved in major surgery, and here I'm told may not endanger your life, but not only that, may not wound yourself. That what we saw in source number 3 wasn't about killing oneself. It was about causing oneself a wound. The word in Hebrew, hachovel, is a term that we use for wounding. So if you're not allowed to wound yourself, how would you be allowed to enter into this? And the answer, of course, is source number 5, among other sources, but number 5 is certainly the best. And this is the law that is known biblically as Lo Sa'amod al Dam Re'echa. How do we know that one who sees another person drowning in a river, or being dragged by a beast, or being beset by bandits, that he must act to save him? The Torah says, you shall not stand by the blood of your peer. You can't stand by while somebody else is being harmed. And here, worth noting, the first case, somebody drowning in a river, is very clearly life and death. Right? That's what is being presented. The second case, the person is being dragged by a beast, may well be life and death. The third case, attacked by bandits, not necessarily. There's a lot of rabbinic discussion as to whether this rule applies in a case of financial harm. What if he's being attacked by bandits? They're going to take his wallet and then they're going to move on. Do you have an obligation to step in? But the general trend of halacha is to say that yes, the obligation is also to save a person from financial harm, not only from physical harm. There are other sources, biblically and rabbinically, that mandate for intervention. I have a mitzvah of hashavas aveda, restoring people their lost property. If I have an obligation that if I know somebody lost a tennis ball, I have to give it back to them, how much more so if I have the ability to help somebody retrieve their lost health? So that's one source that's invoked here. V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. You would want this for yourself. You would like to have two kidneys. So ostensibly, you should want everybody to have two kidneys. So much so that the Gemara in Yuma discusses the case of violating Shabbos in order to save a life and takes it as axiomatic that one must do so. It only debates what the source is for that obligation. The answer in the end in that discussion is that the Torah says, "V'chai bahem v'lo sheyamus bahem." Yes, you're supposed to live by the mitzvos, including Shabbos. That means that you don't die for them. And therefore, you would violate Shabbos in order to save a life. It is considered one of the highest imperatives within Judaism. And so I bring you source number 6, for which I deliberately did not translate because it can be misunderstood. So I decided to just leave it this way, and I'm going to explain it here in the session. But this way, if someone comes across a source sheet without the verbal explanation, it's less potentially confusing. This is a Mishnah. Lefichach nivra adam yechidi. Therefore, humanity was created from one individual, meaning God starts all the creations in Bereishis, in Genesis, with pairs. Zachar and Keva, right? It's multiple. Whereas with human beings, he starts with one. Why did God start with one? Why didn't just start with Adam and Chava in the first place? Lelam gecha to teach you. Shekol ha-me'abed nefesh achas mi-Yisrael, male alav akasov ki'ilu ibed olam male. To teach that whoever saves a single life, and in many contemporary editions it has the word a single Jewish life, is considered as though, one who destroys a single life, is considered as though he had destroyed an entire world. V'chol ha-me'kayem nefesh achas mi-Yisrael, and anyone who saves a single life, and again, in some editions, since it says Jewish, in some it does not. Male alav akasav kilu kiyem olam male. The text considers it as though he had saved an entire world. So I bring this source here first in order to show you saving a life is saving a world. In terms of this word that pops in and out here, is it talking specifically about a Jewish life or a non-Jewish life? Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg notes in his Encyclopedia of Medical Halacha, this is not the old one, this is the new one, HaRefuaka Halacha, which is really an excellent, excellent set of svarim, and I would recommend. It's only in Hebrew, so for those who aren't comfortable with the Hebrew, it's not going to help. But it's really a remarkable work. So he notes in Volume 5, regarding this text, that our oldest manuscripts of Babylonian Talmud, of Jerusalem Talmud, of Mishnah, do not have the word Mi Yisrael. It just says, if you destroy a single life, you have destroyed an entire world. If you save a single life, you have saved an entire world. It is true that if you look at a contemporary edition of the Talmud, you will find the word Mi Yisrael in there. That's why I can't pretend it's not there and just omit it from the text, and that's why I note this. But the earliest manuscripts do not actually have it in there, and it makes sense. Right? Why, from the context of source number 6, does it make sense that it would be about people in general and not just about Jews? Sorry?
One person.
Right. It's talking about, but its basis is Adam. Creation of Adam, who was not Jewish. It's simply about Salam Elohim, saving a human being who's created in the image designed by God. Yes?
So how do you deal with Re'echa?
So, V'hatal Re'echa Kamocha and Lo Samar Adam Re'echa unquestionably become Jewish obligations. There is a higher level obligation for your family. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But but that you are saving an entire world seems to apply Jewish or non-Jewish. There was a question down at the end. Or was there? No? In the area of Gary over there. No. Okay. Okay, question over here. Ellen.
Which is source 5 particularly relevant? Because in situations, the saving person seems to be putting themselves at substantial risk.
Good. We're going there. Not just yet, but we're going to go there. Ellen points out that in source number 5, you're going to intervene to save someone who's drowning in a river. Well, maybe you can do that by, you know, throwing them the rope that you see on the side. But the person's being attacked by a beast. The person is attacked by bandits, you expose yourself to potential harm in order to do this. So yes, we definitely need to discuss this. But what we have right now is, on the one hand, an imperative to protect ourselves. On the other hand, a duty to save the lives of others. So what do you do? Well, we have a wealth of sources in Tanakh in which people expose themselves to risk in order to save others. Can someone give me an example? Yeah. Right. So Dr. Nussbaum points out that you have war as an example of that, and in fact, war is generally considered in Jewish law an exception to all of the rules. Meaning, the Minchas Chinuch asks this question. He wants to know, since we have so many rules about not exposing ourselves to potential harm, so why is there potentially a mitzvah of going to war in various circumstances? And the answer is that war seems to really be viewed as an exception, perhaps because it is about saving the community as opposed to an individual. But even without the legal construct of war, Abraham finds out that his brother-in-law Lot has been taken captive in a war between kings, and he goes racing off to save him. Moshe comes out of the Pharaoh's palace, sees an Egyptian beating a Jew, and intervenes to save the life of the Jew from the Egyptian. And lest one say, well, he is the adopted son of the Pharaoh, and therefore he's safe. Apparently not, because when word gets out that he did it, he has to flee the country. However, it's very hard to bring evidence based on cases in Tanakh, because the people you're dealing with are not, so to speak, your run-of-the-mill people, and you can bring proof from Avram or from Moshe, people who have a different relationship with God altogether. What Moshe's relationship with God is at that point is a good question. But Avram certainly has a thriving relationship with God. Maybe he says, you know what, I know I'm going to be okay. Maybe things are different. It's hard to bring proof from a story in Tanakh about what one could or couldn't do. But when we move to the Talmud, we get a whole bunch of stories which seem to imply that your own life comes first, and you should not expose yourself to harm in order to save others. Take a look, please, at source number 7, which is probably the most famous. Talmud and Bava Metzia. Two people are traveling. One of them is holding a jug of water. If both of them would drink, they both would die before they get to civilization. How do they know that? This is a hypothetical case. This is not, you know, this is not a case you can easily construct in reality. But they know somehow that that if they both drink, they're not making it. If one of them drinks, that one who drank would make it. So what do you do? So Ben Petura is the first sage to weigh in. I'll now repeat from the beginning because not everybody was here at the start. If you could silence phones, that would be good. Ben Petura taught, better for both of them to drink and to die rather than have one of them see the other one die. So he says, share it. You don't want to watch somebody else perish. And in truth, in most cases when I've discussed this this situation with people, that's their gut reaction, is how in the world could I drink knowing that I am condemning the other person to death? Granted, the other person's dying either way, because if you share, you know, that's the way it's going to go. Nonetheless, more often people will say, I couldn't bring myself to drink, I'd give it to the other person. And that will be it. And unfortunately, I mean, this case, in this construct, may be hypothetical, but in the Holocaust, you saw stories like this, people giving their bread to others and so on. The reality of the case exists. So Ben Petura says, you don't want to watch somebody else die while you survive, share the water. Rabbi Akiva says no. He says, the Torah says, when it describes the mitzvah of tzedakah, of helping others, the life of your brother shall be with you. You're supposed to reach out and help so that they can live with you, indicating that your life has to be there. Your life precedes your friend's life, and Rabbi Akiva's guidance is, you save yourself. That's what Rabbi Akiva says to do. Your life comes first before that of another. That's number one. And Rabbi Akiva's position tends to be taken as Jewish law, that that your life does indeed come first. Not that you can actively harm somebody else, but that you're holding the resources. In other words, let's give a different instruction of this case. Let's say both of them are carrying water, and you need the water of both of them in order for one of them to survive. Right? So now, what do you do? A and B are traveling. A's got water, B's got water. If A takes the water from B and drinks his water and B's water, then he's going to survive. What will Rabbi Akiva say to do at that point? Each one drinks their own. Correct. He'll say each one drinks their own. Because at that point, you're certainly not allowed to end someone else's life in order to save your own. Okay, take a look at number 8. Also an interesting source on this, somewhat well known. The Talmud tells the story of some people from the Galil in Israel, about whom word had spread that they had killed someone. This was spread among the Roman authorities. So they came to Rabbi Tarfon. This case that you're talking about, if it's in the time of Rabbi Tarfon, you're going back about 1900 years. They came to Rabbi Tarfon and they said, "Hide us, master." And he said to them, "What should I do? If I don't hide you, they're going to see you. If I hide you, the sages have said one should not accept harmful speech, but one should be concerned for it." Meaning, it's Lashon Hara. What they're saying, when people say that you killed somebody, I can't accept that. I can't believe negative speech about somebody. On the other hand, if you hear rumors that somebody is a dangerous person, you have to protect yourself. You have to be concerned about the potential harm to your life. And so he says, go hide yourselves. That's his answer. His answer is, I'm not going to turn you in, but I'm also not going to take the risk that you actually are a murderer, that you actually are a dangerous person. You follow? You see the case? So what's the mandate that Rabbi Tarfon is giving us then for the case of the person who would want to save others but at risk to themselves? What's he saying? Don't risk yourself, right? That is what he's saying. Don't risk yourself. And then the last case, which is the most controversial of the bunch, it leads into other discussions as well. We're just going to focus on the part that relates to us. But take a look at number 9. There's a spring that's owned by a certain town. How does a town own a spring? What does that mean? It's in their town. It starts where they are. Right? That's where the spring is. They are the first ones to have access to the water. And then it runs downstream. And there's a choice between their lives via access to the spring and the lives of others. So in other words, there's only enough drinking water for one town. If they use it for their drinking, the next town downstream isn't going to have enough for their drinking. So their lives come before those of others, just like Rabbi Akiva number 7, just like Rabbi Tarfon in number 8. Their animals precede the animals of others. If it's between their animals drinking, others' animals drinking, their animals come first. If there's a choice between their laundry and that of others, their laundry comes before that of others as well. If there is a choice between the lives of others and their laundry, the lives of others precede their laundry is the first view, which is what I would have hoped. Rabbi Yossi said, no, their laundry precedes the lives of others. You got to have clean laundry. So there's a lot of discussion on this. Ari.
You talk about Abraham saving Lot. Do we learn anything from Lot saving the angels? That you're thinking he's saving angels. He risks his life to go out and help them.
Right. So it's hard to learn things from Lot. Because you remember the price he was willing to pay in order to save them, right? To hand over his daughters to the mob. So we're a little uncomfortable with Lot. Lot is generally held up as an example of somebody who learned only part of a lesson. Yeah, when we say that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. So he learned that helping others is really, really, really important. But he skipped the part about his daughters. You know, that's I'm afraid to use Lot as a basis. Esther.
I just wanted to bring up, you can only give your kidney once. Is it very selfish to think, I don't think I'm going to give a non-directed donation because I have a whole pack of kids and grandchildren. What if something happens to one of them? And I want to be able to have my kidney, even if I'm not a match.
Right.
They have this system of trading off. You give to somebody else and then they'll give
the donor chain.
Yeah.
Yep. So, indeed true. So, vignettes 5 and 6 are about prioritizing recipients, and number 5 is indeed about a case in which there's a family member who has kidney disease, and therefore the question up, so do I save this for my family member? So I do hope to get to that. It's an excellent, excellent question. But in the laundry case, just so that people know, this isn't just left like this. The Rabbi Yossi says your laundry precedes the lives of others. So one explanation that's offered for this is that there's actually a fear that if the city goes without washing water, that it's going to lead to other disorders for them, and that's one explanation. Another explanation that's offered is, you know, the people in the other town could move. They don't want to move, but they have options. And so it's a matter of saying to them, my laundry comes before your comfort in getting to stay where you are. That's another explanation that's offered for this case. But the reason I bring it here is simply because it follows the principle of 7 and 8, which is your life comes before the lives of others. So far, so good. Your life first. What we haven't done, clearly, is to discuss levels of risk. Right? That hasn't been a part of this conversation yet. We've just been taking this very black and white. If you drink, you survive. If you don't drink, you don't survive. We have not discussed levels of risk here. But we will. That's going to be part of this. We also have to see source number 10, because not every case in the Talmud supports this idea that your life comes first. Amemar, Mar Zutra, and Rav Ashi were sitting at the entrance of the palace of King Izgur. The king's butler was passing by with a lot of food for the king. Rav Ashi saw Mar Zutra's face turn pale. There's a sense that because he's very hungry, and now he has smelled the food, he's actually at medical risk. The Talmud has this concept of the medicine of their day. It was certainly very strong. That a person could experience a craving for food, which would actually pose mortal danger if it went unsatisfied. How this fits at all with modern medicine, I don't know. Here I go back to saying I'm not a doctor. But Rav Ashi sees his face turn pale. So he takes some of the food with his finger, he dips his finger into the pan, and he takes some out, and he put it in the mouth of Mar Zutra. Yes, the food presumably is not kosher. The butler says to him, you have ruined the king's feast, how dare you? And they asked him, Rav Ashi, why did you do that? To which he said, one who does this ruins the king's food. I meant to ruin the meal. They said to him, why? And he told them, I saw leprous pork in the food. I saw diseased meat in this pan, and I was actually saving the king from trouble by putting my finger in it. Now they won't eat it. They checked, the butler checks, and doesn't see anything like that in the pan. He put his finger on it. Rabashi puts his finger on it. He says, right over there, did you check here? And they checked, and lo and behold, there is this piece of leprous pork in the king's meal. The assumption is not that he actually had seen any such thing. The assumption is that miraculously this shows up in order to save his skin. So the sages said to Rabashi, why did you rely on a miracle? To which he says, I saw tzaraat breaking out on my zutra. Tzaraat here does not mean the biblical tzaraat. It means some kind of symptom of a disorder such that he was going to die if he didn't eat now. And so to save his life, I exposed myself to risk. Doesn't that go against what we said in the first three sources? How do you justify that? What would you do? How does this make sense if we've been told your life comes first? Something?
Maybe yeah. He didn't think it was a risk to his life, like that he wouldn't be killed. Maybe he'd be in trouble, but not necessarily killed.
Right. Maybe he thought, I won't get the death penalty for this. Maybe. We're going to come back to this. There are a couple of different approaches that are taken. But first, I want to show you one other source in number 11. This is quoted more commonly than number 10. Passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. Rabbi Isi Itzid B'Safsufa. Rabbi Isi was captured in a certain dangerous area. The sage Rabbi Yonatan said, let the corpse be wrapped in its sheet. He's done. We can't do anything for him. Reish Lakish said, absolutely not. I will kill him. Not him. I will kill those who have taken him captive, or I will be killed. I'm going to go save him by force. Action hero. He went and appeased them. He actually negotiated and succeeded in getting Rav Isi returned. So Reish Lakish is willing to endanger himself in order to save others, inconsistent with what we've said so far. So how do you resolve this? So I'm going to come back to the Reish Lakish story in a moment, but just to show you, sorry?
Good example. He's the abandoned.
Good. So that's one answer to the Reish Lakish story. I'll tell you now. I was going to wait a minute, but I'll say it now. The Reish Lakish has a history. He goes through a period in his life when he is indeed a bandit before he meets Rabbi Yochanan, and more importantly, Rabbi Yochanan's sister. And at that point, he changes his ways. And therefore, some argue he's not a good example because indeed he has special abilities that the other sages don't, and he has confidence, I can do it. And maybe that's even why he's successful in his negotiation. I'm going to come back to that story. But first, in terms of the story with Rabbi Ashi and the food, number 12 I brought you from Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg's work that I mentioned earlier, HaRefuaka Halacha. He says, some have proved from here, from this case of Rabashi, that one must put himself into possible danger to save another from danger. But they have rejected this for several reasons. First suggestion, from Rav Avadya Yosef, Rabashi was confident in his righteousness and did not see this as miraculous, and was not in danger. He knew God was going to take care of him, like the suggestion I made about Avraham saving Lot. I know God's going to take care of me. Second, Rabashi was close to the government and was not in danger. Meaning, what's he doing sitting in front of the palace? And why is it that when he put his finger in the king's food, the people there had a dialogue with him? The answer is, they knew him. And therefore, he felt, I have enough capital to work with. But the third explanation to me is the one that rings the most true. Some prove the opposite. One may not put himself in possible danger to save another from danger. The sages were angry at Ravashi for relying on a miracle. Meaning, they said to him, what are you doing? Right? In other words, he did this saying, I need to save Marzutra. This wasn't Psak. This wasn't the halachic ruling. This was, I need to save Marzutra. And in fact, the sages opposed him for having done so. You could bring this as proof the other way. But in terms of the Jerusalem Talmud, Reish Lakish's story, that causes some trouble here. So some suggest that that this Rav Isi was actually one of the greatest sages of the generation, and he felt Rav Isi is unique, and I need to endanger myself in order to save him. He was somebody of special standing. And And some suggest the idea that indeed Reish Lakish was special. Reish Lakish had special talents, and therefore he knew he could go ahead and be safe in doing this. However, yes, all right. Okay. However, there's another way to look at it. It's really important when you look at Jewish law that you not see every problem as something that can be solved. Meaning, I'm trying to harmonize the sources so that my three sources in the Babylonian Talmud that said your life comes first are not in conflict with this passage in the Jerusalem Talmud that seems to say no, you endanger yourself to save somebody else. Sometimes the answer is it's a machlokes, it's a debate. Not everybody agrees, even on an issue as serious as this. And indeed, that was the position of a work called Agudat Ezov, quoted in the Pesach Tshuva in source number 13, where he says the position of Agudat Ezov is, in fact, that early rabbinic authorities did not quote the story of Reish Lakish in their debates because they contend that our Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, disagrees with the Jerusalem Talmud on this. And what is the rule when the Babylonian Talmud disagrees with the Jerusalem Talmud? Babylonian wins for a variety of historical reasons. The yes. Yes, Ellen.
The comment you made before that somebody said that perhaps the reason Reish Lakish could endanger himself is because Rabbi Yossi was such an important person.
Yes.
Would our whole discussion be different if we're talking about donating a kidney to a gadol hador as opposed to...
You bet. You bet. That'll be vignette number 6, which I still think we can get to. I gave it there in terms of the soldier in the IDF who was wounded, as opposed to somebody who has kidney disease. Is there any way to prioritize between them? And yes, that will apply to others with a particular value to society, and I do expect to get to it. So the answer is yes, it's a very important consideration, including this line about Rav Yossi being the great leader of the generation. So, if this is in fact a debate, and the Babylonian Talmud normally wins, then my answer right now would be, you can't endanger yourself, or you can't enter a certain level of danger, because again, we have not gone into the question of what if the level of risk to you is 3 in 10,000, as opposed to where the level of risk to you is, no one gets away from those bandits alive. Right? You have to still deal with the question of gauging level of risk. However, before we can get to that, it's worth noting that it's not so clear-cut that we're just going to follow the Babylonian Talmud over the Jerusalem Talmud here. Not clear-cut. Take a look at source number 14, which is a controversial source, the Rambam, Maimonides. He writes the following in codifying the law of intervening to save the lives of others. One who can save and does not rescue violates, you shall not stand by if the blood of your peer is shed. Right? That's straightforward. We think. Also, one who sees another drown at sea or attacked by bandits or a wild beast and who could save him personally or by hiring people to rescue him and he does not do so, violates, you shall not stand by as your brother's blood is shed. I actually translated the same sentence two different ways within that paragraph. I apologize. That's sloppy. I know why it happened, but don't worry about it. It's meaningless as a distinction. But the point is in the words that I underlined. The Rambam says twice within that sentence, within that passage, one who could save, implying that if there is if you don't know whether you could save, right? You might be able to. You might not be able to. You're not necessarily obligated. But as some read it, what he's actually saying is, you have no obligation to endanger yourself. When the Rambam writes, one who could save, he means, if you could save and be okay, then you're obligated. But if you're not going to be okay, then you're not obligated. It's not clear what Maimonides is actually saying here. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, the Bach, thinks he knows what the Rambam means. He says the Rambam wrote, and who could save him, one who could save, which indicates that it is only where there is no doubt that he can save him, but he need not put himself in possible danger to save another. The way that he reads the Rambam is that the Rambam is indeed following the Babylonian Talmud and saying, don't endanger yourself in order to save somebody else. That's what he thinks the Rambam says. And then he notes that the 15th century work, the Tur, a major work of Jewish law, which brings what Rambam says, but says the Rambam wrote, instead of presenting it as his own view, he says the Tur said the Rambam wrote, apparently disagreeing with what the Tur had previously written. In other words, saying, I am not on the same page. The Rambam believes you don't endanger yourself. I believe you do endanger yourself. But Hagot Maimoniot, in an old text, is found to have written, the Jerusalem Talmud concludes that one should even put himself in possible danger, and Beit Yosef cites it. In other words, you have Hagot Maimoniot, which says that the Jerusalem Talmud believes, and the Rambam believes, that you do enter danger. And that, as far as the Bach is concerned, that's what the Tur thinks. However, he thinks the Tur read the Rambam differently. This is a little bit scrambled. So let me try that again. You have a text in the Rambam, I'm going to work through historically. You have a text in the Rambam where he says, if you can save, you're obligated to do so. One school of thought, the Bach school of thought, thinks that what the Rambam is saying is that you're only obligated to do so in the event that you can do it safely. That's one school of thought. The Tur, on the other hand, does not agree with the Rambam, and the Tur believes that, in fact, you are supposed to endanger yourself. And the Bach sees that in the Tur's read of the situation. The Hagot Maimoniot actually thinks the Rambam agrees with the Tur and says you have to endanger yourself. So I have a debate about what the Rambam, what Maimonides believes. Do I need to endanger myself? Am I not obligated to endanger myself? But it's very clear that the Tur thinks that I am supposed to, in fact, enter into danger in order to save myself. And then you get source number 16, the Sma. The Sma is a work on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law. And he notes that when you get to the level of the Code of Jewish Law in the 16th century, they don't quote the idea that you should risk yourself in order to save the lives of others. They do not bring the passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. They don't go that route. And he says the reason they don't quote it is because they don't agree with it. They believe that you do not endanger yourself. They do not quote you the Hagos Maimonides, his view of the Rambam. That's not there. In other words, he believes that Psak is, that the ruling is, you do not give up your life in order to save somebody else. Now I have finally come back to the point about levels of risk. I'm fast-forwarding, because we want to deal with so many cases, I'm fast-forwarding Jewish history here and the whole debate about what constitutes risk, including the 10% rules of. In order to get to what contemporary authorities actually say on this. So, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook pointed to the case in the Talmud in Nedarim, where the sages there, if you go back to the Nedarim case in source number 9, right? The view of the sages was, if it's a choice between your life and the lives of others, your life comes first. But the laundry case, he understood to be a case of potential risk to your city. And the sages said, then the lives of others come first, and you have to enter into the potential risk. Because it's a low-level risk. If you're not doing the laundry, whatever contagious disease is going to develop, or whatever it is a lower-level risk than dying of thirst for the other city. So Tzvi Yehuda Cook used that to argue that if it's a low level of risk to your life, and the other person is going to die, then indeed you do endanger your life. And that becomes not just an option, but an imperative. And he applies that as well to the Reish Lakish case. Reish Lakish, perhaps due to his experience, was only in low risk. But there was risk. But he felt he was obligated to do something because the other party is in serious danger of death. And in practice, that's the ruling that halachic authorities give. I gave you one example in source number 17. The Aruch HaShulchan, the Hebrews on the bottom of one side, the English on the top of the next side. Rabbi Chaim Michael Epstein, a major authority in Jewish law from the beginning of the 20th century. The authority cited it from the Jerusalem Talmud that one must save others, and the early authorities omitted it because our Babylonian Talmud makes clear that one need not put himself into this level of danger, but all is case-specific, and one should weigh the matter carefully and not be too protective of one's self. Don't be too protective of oneself. You have to recognize the need to save others, even if it involves some small degree of danger. And that's something that there's a lot of literature on. I am sandwiching it in by bringing it to the Aruch HaShulchan because it's a ruling that people rely on. There's a lot more behind that. But, yes, sorry.
I'm just thinking of Queen Esther.
Right. So Queen Esther is another one who's hard to bring as an example. It's a good case. The reason why it's hard to bring as an example is what? Why is Queen Esther hard to bring as an example? It's the whole nation. It's the whole nation. So that changes the rules. And that will go back towards vignette number 6 and the question of prioritizing. But that's why Esther is hard to use as a basis. But we've cheated things a little bit along the way here. By presenting this as the lives of others versus your own life, right, with measures of risk along the way, we've cheated one question, which is, just how far do we go when we say that you have to save somebody's life with whatever you have at your disposal? Let's give a different case. The Talmud has a discussion about what to do if there's somebody who is deathly ill on Shabbos and the doctors say they need a hamburger. I understand that popular medicine doesn't prescribe that. I think we might live in a happier time if doctors did. But that's what the doctors say. The doctors say, this person needs a hamburger in order to survive. And they don't have meat on hand. So what do you do? What's the answer? It's Shabbos. What do you do? You shout, right? You do whatever you have to do to get that person meat in order that that person should be able to survive. Isn't it interesting that when we look at that case, nobody says, go through the town. Someone's got to have meat. Right? Why don't we do that?
Because it might cause a delay.
So one concern is delay. But there's another piece to it, which is... Sorry? Yeah, shechting is going to take a while, you know. The shochet's got to go to mikvah. It's a whole process. That's right. Also, that's a discussion actually there in the Gemara. But the answer seems to be that rather than take away other people's Shabbos meal, we're going to create fresh for this person, assuming that you can. But the point is, and this has many ramifications in other situations, we don't demand everything of somebody in order to save others. And I'm going to cheat that discussion by not going into that in depth, but just to point out that here also, it's not simply a matter of you're saving somebody's life, you flip the switch, now somebody's life is saved. You're giving your organ. Right, I keep using kidney as an example because it's in my head because I spoke for renewal on Wednesday night. But but fill in the blank with another organ. You're giving a body part. That's not the same thing as writing a check. And that's not viewed that way necessarily within halacha. The question came up back in the 13th century via a rabbi, Rav Menachem Rikanati, or as he's often known as the Rikanti. Take a look, please, at source number 18. Terrible case. If the government tells a Jew, let me cut off one aver non-fatally or I will kill your fellow Jew. Here's your offer. I'm going to cut off a part of your body non-fatally, nothing fatal, you know, an ear or something. Or if you refuse, I'm killing the other guy. They're sadistic. I don't know how this actually happens, but that's the case. Some say he must let them cut off the body part, since he won't die. Let it go. And here's the argument he brings in on behalf of that. He says, look, Shabbos is so strict that loss of an aver does not override it. If a person knows that by delaying their medical procedure, they will lose a part of their body, but it's not fatal. There's a lot of discussion about which body parts qualify for this, also beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about right now. But Shabbos overrides the need for an aver, and you override Shabbos in order to save a life. So clearly, saving a life is more important than saving an aver. I'm just not translating the word Aver because it doesn't have an English analog. People translate it as organ, but Aver is not an organ. A tooth is also an Aver. Your finger is also an Aver. Body part is not a translation either, because not all body parts are Avarim. We have a list in the Mishnah and Alos of 248 Avarim. So I just leave it as the word Aver. It doesn't matter for our purposes. It doesn't mean anything other than body part in this context. So his statement is simple. Saving a life is more important than saving your ear. So therefore, give up the ear. That's his position. That question that he raised was debated over the centuries. Rabbi David ben Shlomo ibn Avi Zimra, the Radbaz, in source number 19, says, no, you can't tell me that's obligatory. He says, it's Midas Chasidus, this is a pious trait. But that's it. And he brings arguments to demonstrate that, including the following argument. And further, he says, it is written of the Torah, her ways are ways of pleasantness. The laws of our Torah must fit intellect and logic. How could we think that one would let someone blind his eye or cut off his hand or foot so that he wouldn't kill somebody else? He says, you can't demand that of somebody. It may be pious for them to do so, but that's as far as he's willing to go. Therefore, I see no reason for this law other than a pious trait. And if it may be fatal, which is another concern of his, he says a person can die from any surgery. He's writing this in the 16th century. The person certainly could die from any surgery at that point. He says, if it may be fatal, this is a pious fool, for his doubt, possible threat to his life, overrides the other one's certainty. So Radbaz says, you can't require somebody to give up a limb, and that becomes a significant voice. The position of Radbaz becomes a significant voice in the discussion of organ donation, even if it is not life-threatening, to say, you can't call this obligatory. Clear so far? Okay. So what we have at this stage, before we now get to the answers to our questions, and we'll look at some contemporary authorities on it, is, first of all, framing this as potential harm to one's life or one's physical well-being. On the other hand, the duty to protect others. We've said also you have a duty to protect your own life. It's a religious duty, not just what you personally like to do. And what we said is that from the Talmud you bring sources that indicate your own life comes first. We can also bring sources that indicate you endanger your life to save the lives of others. The resolution seems to be, in the end, from the Shulchan Aruch, your life does indeed come before the lives of others, but halachic authorities say, if it's a small risk, then you take it. We did not define what small risk equals. We didn't say 10%, 20%, what exactly that includes. We haven't yet said. And then the separate discussion of losing a body part in order to save somebody else, and the Radbaz saying that's not something the Torah is going to require of you. So let's go back now to our first question. The person who is a good candidate for kidney transplant, it's considered to be a good match. The person's in good health. They think that she's pretty safe to donate. What would you say, based on what we've said so far? No obligation, but allowed. Allowed, but no obligation. Anything else? Maybe not. Okay.
It really depends on the severity of the kidney diseases in the recipient.
Correct. It definitely depends on what you are saving them from. And that goes back to the question of, they could live for some period of time. Maybe that changes things. On the other hand, who knows when they're going to find another match. That's part of this as well.
So does that mean that you have to specifically know who you're donating to? Like, these people who's in like a random chain of kidney donation, that sort of thing?
So it seems like you do need to know not who they are necessarily, but you have to know what you have to know the level of risk involved to them. You need to know enough medical facts about their case in order to be able to answer this question. That would seem to be correct. I will note that, as I understand it, and someone please correct me if I'm understanding this incorrectly, but from what I've read online, the protocol here is actually you do meet the recipient. Is that correct? That's what I've read about it being done in Ontario, that you actually meet the person who is
they could also just have a hospital, you have to meet the person before he has a place to stop.
Internet. Toronto General requires it.
General, I think, is the only place. Yeah, in the city area, you need the first dinosaur.
Interesting. Okay. Why do they require it? What's the logic? Okay.
Does the age of the recipient matter?
Does the age of the recipient matter? So we'll get to that a little bit when we talk about the prioritizing recipients issue.
I told somebody he's unlikely to be a candidate because he's too old.
The candidate to receive or the candidate to give?
Candidate
to receive.
That's true.
Interesting. They, without disclosing anything about them, just what's their what age range is it that they've been
about
told?
75.
About 75. Interesting. Okay.
There is a difference. I'm not an expert in this by any means, but I think there is also a big difference between liver and kidney. I think the risks of donation with liver are probably higher. And also just another interesting thing, in the past they never used to give donations to people who had cirrhosis from alcoholic liver disease. Mm-hmm. Now they will. Would that be a halachic?
There's just case now. Actually, it's been publicized in the last week about a young guy who needs a liver and has been told that he can't get the liver unless he stops drinking, and he hasn't stopped drinking.
So when
they're taking him to the courts now.
And would that be an issue from halakhically also if right. You know they've caused themselves injury to come to this point?
Right. The question of whether what happens if they've actually caused themselves to come to this point is a little more complicated. We can discuss it when we do the prioritizing of recipients. But in terms of this case at hand, the issue of the candidate, it is true that halakhic authorities generally take the position that it is a pious thing to do. I brought you Rav Avadya Yosef in number 20. I didn't translate it, not because it's particularly sensitive, but because it was long and I was, you know, already at 7 pages. But Rav Avadya's position on this is that it is a good thing to do. He says that the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg, who opposed kidney donation in the early days of transplant, would change his mind now because the medical facts are different, because it's not as dangerous now as it was back then. And therefore, he says, it appears to him that we should permit the donation of a kidney. But he says he's not going to consider it obligatory, but he does say that it is that it is an okay thing to do, and it fulfills the mitzvah of not standing by while somebody is in danger. Rav Asher Weiss, a major authority in Israel today, answers halakha questions for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel, in source number 21, is stronger. He says, regarding kidney donation, if I did not fear my peers, my heart would be inclined to say that today it is entirely obligatory. For all studies show that the danger to the donor is very low, almost non-existent, and the possibility of saving a life is very great. He doesn't go that step. He says, I'm afraid to because, you know, nobody else is on the same page as I am. And this is, you know, potentially a life and death issue. So he is willing to say it's obligatory when he deals with blood. And we're going to come back to blood donation. And he does say it's obligatory, I believe, when it comes to bone marrow, interestingly. But he does not say it. He stops short when he deals with the kidney case that he's discussing here. And that's where the authorities in general are. Rav Shmuel Wozner, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Chaim David Alevi, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rav Meir Mazuz, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, Rav Sternbach, all of them tend to say, this is a pious thing to do, even though you're entering into risk, but it is not obligatory. And I brought you from Rabbi Dr. Steinberg in number 22, where he says this. Where he says this as well. He is dealing with a case of what I translated as terminal renal insufficiency in the Hebrew, isfikat klayot sofit. I thought that was the translation of the technical term. But he says you're not obligated to do it. Now let's go back to add the. Sorry? Irreversible? You think sofit is irreversible?
End stage.
End stage is what I would have said. That's why I wrote terminal.
End stage renal disease and candidates for... So they don't have to have a transplant. I mean, it would be nice, but it doesn't have to. So it...
But I mean...
I think there's a different...
No, there is a subsegment.
No, that's right. There's a subsegment.
What do you mean?
There are tons of people with end stage renal disease who are on dialysis. But you wouldn't say it's terminal. There's a subsegment, as you said, that are terminal.
Right. Right. I think the issue of dialysis really poses this fascinating question of, number one, saving somebody now versus saving them eventually, the as well as the question of dialysis coming with its own risks, not only inconvenience and pain, but risks to life. And that's where the case-by-case nature of this comes into play. I'm going to jump, though, because there's so much going here that we want to get to. What about potential long-term risk? So I noted before in the vignette the possibility that there is long-term risk. Kidney.ca in number 23 says that regarding long-term physical risks, there are minor risks which should not cause any long-term health problems and may include slight increased risk of high blood pressure, slight increased incidence of kidney failure, possibility of injuring the remaining kidney. The kidney that remains grows larger to do the work formerly done by two kidneys. It becomes heavier, thus making it more vulnerable to injury. After donation, contact sports should be avoided. Slight risk of developing a disease of the remaining kidney. But generally, they seem to be very optimistic. On the other hand, not every study has... Sorry? I'm not the one to say that, but you said it, doctor. I'm sorry, there are studies that seem to support that. If you take a look at 24, the conclusion of a study from 2008, donor nephrectomy was performed with low surgical morbidity and comparable results of clinical and laboratory data to the age-matched general population. I saw some very interesting arguments against this philosophy of matching against the age-matched general population. Why is this not necessarily a good match? Why is that not necessarily a good comparison?
Donors may be healthier.
Exactly. Right. The donors, this self-selected group, right, is a group of people who have been tested and found to be healthier. So therefore, it's not fair to match them up against the general population. Match them against people who actually have their physical qualities. Take a look at number 25, please. Risk of living kidney donation. However, donor nephrectomy exposes the donor to risks associated with surgery. In addition, some studies have suggested that living kidney donation may confer small but measurable increases in the risks of hypertension, preeclampsia, gout, and end-stage renal disease. Number 26, lifetime risks of kidney donation, a medical decision analysis. Live kidney donation may reduce life expectancy by half a year to a year in most donors. Most donors. The development of ESRD in donors may not be the only measure of risk, as most of the predicted loss of life predates ESRD. They don't get a chance to develop it. The study identifies the potential importance of following donors and treating risk factors aggressively to prevent ESRD and to improve donor survival. So now what do you do? There is a potential risk in this case, and it is apparently meaningful. So what would you say from a Jewish law perspective if you're given this data? Now what do you do? Uh-oh. You know, one of the requirements for accreditation is that this be interactive. So
it's not a fee, but it's still possibly mutar.
Based on?
Based on, I have to look at the exact numbers of what the risks were for the individual in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But I would suspect it's mutar.
Okay. Because the risk isn't high enough. And what about the loss of a year of life? Meaning, let's say it was a risk, but a risk of losing a year of life.
But you can only predict that for a population, not for an individual.
Correct. That's always going to be true. There was a hand over here, Brian.
Yeah, it's comparable to the losing an aider.
Mm-hmm.
Takes away some of the
obligatoriness. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we do have a concern in Jewish law about watching out for long-term health. We had a discussion in a session at Shari Shemayim last year about CPAP machines on Shabbos. And the argument that it is pikuach nefesh, it is considered life-saving, because for people with a certain level of sleep apnea, there's a warning that over a period of 20 years... they could potentially develop cardiac problems. And that's oversimplifying. We discussed the medical issues in that session. But based on that, indeed, the argument is made that it is considered pikuach nefesh. It's considered life-saving to use a sleep apnea machine on Shabbos. If you take a look at source number 27, we get a story that's not a sleep apnea story, but I brought it in that year. Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav, told a doctor that saving a life is not specifically the case of someone who is now dangerously ill and will die. Even if fasting would affect the person years later when the disease will recur, and so fasting now will cause him to die early, this is called saving a life. He is required to eat. You can't fast if it could cause a problem for the person in 20 years from now.
If you can't, it's going to cause a problem for the kidney donation 20 years from now, you shouldn't give it.
For the kidney donor, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's the question. That's what we're asking.
But that's the reverse of it. You're saying that if it's...
No, he's saying that in the event that fasting would pose a risk to your health 20 years from now, then don't fast now. That's the argument. And it comes up in terms of the sleep apnea machine. Take a look at 28. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham. And I couldn't believe it when I read this. And I emailed him to ask him, and he confirmed it by email. On Shabbos or Yom Tov, he should activate the machine. He's talking CPAP. Via Shabbos clock, set to activate the machine before the patient goes to sleep and to halt it in the morning after he rises. If there is a need, he should turn on the machine in an unusual way, such as with the back of his finger. When he rises, he should leave the machine on until after Shabbos. This actually isn't the full quote that I wanted, but the full quote that I wanted, he actually said that the logic here is that it is chola sheyesh bo sakana. He said it is considered to be somebody whose life is in danger. I find it really difficult because when I talk to people who actually have CPAP machines, an awful lot of them don't use them every night. Yeah, they'll skip it on Thursday, but suddenly Friday night I got to turn it on.
But it's also not only long term. There, you know, it can be acute as well. So it's a bit muddy here as well.
Because there is the short term risk also.
Yeah.
Correct. Like they said, you may not live long enough to develop ESRD. Take a look at number 29, just one last source on this issue of long-term threats. When a situation or path, he's not talking about kidney donation here, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, he's just writing in general. When a situation or path begins now without danger, if it becomes clear that it will lead to danger in the future, this also involves saving a life now. So based on that, you could argue that long-term risk will actually prohibit, not just say it's a pious trait, but could actually prohibit kidney donation. However, three important points. Important point number one is not everybody agrees to this assessment of long-term risk. So Moshe Heineman on the CPAP discussion in source number 30 says it's called chola she'ein bo sakana. It's called somebody who's ill, but not dangerously so if you're just worried about long-term risk. That's number one. Number two is you have to go back to the question of just how high the risk is. And here I quote you in source number 31, a passage from the Gemara based on a pasuk that was actually this week's Torah reading. It was talking about the obligation to pay workers on the day that they do the work for you. And the Torah dramatizes it by saying, you know, this person put his life on the line in order to do work for you. And the Talmud comments on that and says, he climbed the ramp, he became suspended from a tree, whatever work he was doing, and he gave his life over to death for the sake of his wages. Based on that, the Talmud states, and indeed it is brought as halakha, a person is permitted to enter into a certain level of risk for the sake of gain, where that risk is considered cost of doing business. So we don't say you're not allowed to become a construction worker because you have to go up on tall buildings and there's a level of risk in being up on tall buildings. If this is considered a normal risk to take within society, you're allowed to take it. You want to drive on Bathurst? Go ahead, drive on Bathurst. That's considered a normal risk that people take. That's the way. Sorry?
Crossing Bathurst.
Crossing. Yes?
I just have a question going back to your donor, Shira. Like, we're talking now about potential risk.
Yes.
You say that she's 37 and she's healthy, but you don't say anything about, does she have kids? How many kids has she had? You know, is she in a position where she's likely to have kids? That sort of thing. And does that weigh into some of these situations where you're talking
about longer-term risk and potential outcomes.
Right. So insofar as it increases the risk for her, you know, either her ability to have, I don't know that this affects her ability to have children, does it?
Probably not.
Probably mentioned preeclampsia as a risk.
Mm, right, that's true.
Yeah.
Right. So then I think it is a factor. Right. Then I think it presents an interesting factor. On the other hand, that's a circumstance that doesn't even exist right now. She's planning on it. And so I think it becomes less of a fact. Let me think about that. That's going to be, those who weren't here in the beginning, I said that I use the email list to send out follow-up on questions that come up in the course of a shiur. So this is going to be one of them. I'm going to look into this because I think it's a really interesting question to go back to. And so I'm going to send out, I expect, a follow-up email with material on that. The question of, what if she's planning on becoming pregnant? And insofar as she is, giving a kidney now could actually create a problem down the road. I think it's a really interesting question. I don't want to give a quick answer to that. So if you didn't sign in, where are the sign-in sheets? Okay, so please make sure that you... Okay, this one has room, so if you want to pass it around, that would be great. But in terms of this question that we're wrestling with here, what about the long-term risk, and how does that factor of Moshe Feinstein in source number 32... says that when it comes to protecting your health, he says there is no obligation upon a person to avoid low-risk dangers. It's a good thing to do, but it's not obligatory for a person to avoid low-risk dangers. And again, so what qualifies as low risk? You can make the argument for the 10% standard, as Zev mentioned earlier. That's a standard that appears in other areas of halacha. You can make the argument based on what society considers normal, which Rav Schechter does in certain cases, such as end-of-life care. That if this is considered a normal risk to take, it's considered normal, and therefore you have the option of doing so. The third factor here is a very interesting one from the Binyan Tzion Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. He says, if the risk doesn't exist at all at the moment, you have grounds for ignoring it. If the risk does not exist right now, but it could develop from a case down the line, then you have grounds to ignore it. This came up in our vaccination discussion when we had a share on vaccination a while back, and the question of, does a person have the right in halacha to avoid vaccination? For the record, for anyone who wasn't there, yes, I am pro-vaccination. But Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger makes the point that the concern for a danger that doesn't yet exist would really prevent people from functioning altogether. And so Rabbi Dr. Steinberg in source number 34 says, if there's no current threat, even though it could develop later from the circumstances, this is not included as, quote, saving a life. And they did not, he's dealing with a different case. He's talking about saving somebody from such a threat. And he says that if there's no current threat to somebody, even though it could develop later, that's not called a life and death scenario. So flipping that now to refer to the donor, a long-term risk like that doesn't exist right now, he doesn't consider to be immediate risk, which would permit the donation. So what we're saying here, to sum up some of the back and forth, and I recognize I'm rushing a little bit at this point to get more of the material in, but what we end up saying is the following. When you're dealing with long-term risk, there are those who will equate that with current risk and say it's like you're giving up a year of your life right now. And that would potentially be even stronger than giving up just the Aver, where it inhibits one's existence. It's like you're giving up a year of life right now, and therefore I would argue it would not be permissible. However, long-term health is not a factor according to everybody. Whether because of the uncertainty between now and then, or the fact that they could die of something else, whether because these people take normal risks like that in the course of life that can indeed abbreviate a person's life, whether you're going to take the argument of the risk doesn't exist at all in the moment, it's about something that may develop down the road. For all of these reasons, I think that a rabbi could make the argument that even if the studies do show a loss of a year of life potentially down the road, such as due to ESRD, it would still be justified and one would be allowed to make the decision to donate.
Yes?
Yes?
Is
it
a
good
idea to
Yes?
I see how you can negate the risks long-term, but there still are risks in the moment.
Right, the risks that are in the moment, I think, is where the Midas Chassidus comes up. The idea that it's a trait of piety and not an obligation because of the level of risks in the moment, that's what makes it non-obligatory. But I don't think it will make it prohibited. I don't think it meets that threshold. The blood donation, so at this point, just because I want to make sure to cover at least some of what we talked about in the beginning, I'm going to stop reading the sources aloud, but they're here on the page, and just speak. So when it comes to blood donation, the halachic authorities tend to be very positive. The Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg was not a fan because he pointed to the biblical text that says Hadam hu hanefesh, that blood is life, and therefore you're giving your life. So he said it's not obligatory to do so. But halachic authorities tend to be strongly in favor of blood donation. The Shevet HaLevi I brought you on the sheet, Rishmo Wesner in source number 35, says that you have to give blood if you have a unique element not found in others, or if there's somebody right here who needs the blood, if it comes obligatory. He says it's not a dangerous thing to do. If you go back to the Talmud, people let blood all the time. So he argues that it's not considered dangerous, and he said, don't tell me about the pain that's involved, because pain exempts you from sitting in the sukkah. Pain doesn't exempt you from giving blood. That's a more glib formulation that he gives, but that's basically his argument. Rav Moshe Feinstein said in the event, and I brought it at number 36, even if you don't have a specific person who needs it right now, he says you can give blood. The Minchas Asher of Asher Weiss does so as well. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg says it is a mitzvah to do it. Blood regenerates, and the danger is considered non-significant at this point, and especially if you have a rare blood type. They're all very much in favor of blood donation. Our fourth case that we had, which we did not read aloud, I'll read aloud just for a moment. Jason, a nephrology social worker, is on the transplant team working with Shira in preparation for the transplant. He knows that she is an observant Jew. What should Jason know that would help him advise Shira regarding her family's input in her decision-making process? So this was a fascinating question to look at. Halacha generally views a responsible adult as autonomous, with the ability to make decisions independently. Nonetheless, it assumes that we consult family. So we had a session a few years back on incapacity and who gets to say what happens in the event that somebody lacks capacity. And we saw a statement from our Moshe Feinstein, which I brought you in number 37, which he applied not just to a case of incapacity, but also to a case of indecision. And he takes it as a given that you look to family members to make decisions. They are responsible for each other's medical care. They're responsible for each other's well-being. And so, of course, you consult family, writes Rabbi Feinstein. At the time, I think it was Zev who asked the question in the class, we noted that Rabbi Feinstein did not include spouses in his material. He said the parents and the general family. So I asked Rav Herschel Schechter that question about spouses, and he confirmed that the spouse is generally assumed that they've been married for a period of time to know what it is that person wants, and to know the spouse, who may not be conscious at that point. But more than that, certain family members have unique claims to be consulted. So, for example, one's parents. We have a mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, of honoring your parents. So, therefore, you have to consult them. However, you do not have to listen to them. You have to listen but not obey. Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, in his Shiurei Torah L'Rofim, dealt with this question, and he argued, I brought it for you in number 38, that even if the parents oppose the donation, since fundamentally you are saving somebody's life potentially, and again, type of donation, is it saving a life, not saving a life, he argued that overrides parental concern. But the spouse case is fascinating. In the case of the spouse, a wife has certain physical claims on a husband, whether that's in terms of conjugal relations, ona, periviria, producing children, the obligation to support her financially. A wife has prior claims on the husband, and the husband has claims on her as well as part of their relationship. So that the ruling seems to be from Rabbi Yashiv on this issue, Rabbi Yosef Shalom El Yashiv, that if there's any fear of harm to their ability to perform whatever their obligations are to the other, then you have to consult the spouse. And he says, far from it being a pious thing to do, to donate, at that point it becomes theft, because you're stealing from your spouse. So he seems fairly strong in not doing it, and that's why I thought the following was interesting. Even though that's Rabbi Yashiv's statement, his son-in-law, Rav Zilberstein, in his Shiurei Torah L'Rofim, who quotes his father-in-law, in his summary, says something a little bit different. In number 38, he says the wife opposes the donation, he says, sorry, in the case where the wife opposes the donation, he backs down from Rabbi Yashiv's point regarding the spouse, and what he says instead is, yeah, take a look at it. It's right here in number 38. He says, when the wife of the donor opposes the donation, he says, it is still considered to be a pious thing to do, to donate. However, if it would lead to divorce, then maybe you're not obligated to lose both your kidney and your wife. That's what he says. The first word in number 38 was confusing me, because I think I cut off a letter when I retyped it. It should not say dumb. It should say adam. There's an aleph there. Yeah, I was wondering what I did there. Okay. In terms of prioritizing recipients, we have only 1 minute left on our time. But everybody asked about this. So I'm just going to tell you very, very briefly, and we'll have to revisit it in a future session. We do prioritize when it comes to donations. First of all, we prioritize family in general when it comes to helping others. The Torah says, "La'achicha la'aniyecha," you have an obligation to family first. And that's really important to note. We also prioritize those who provide value to the community, and that comes back to the Gadol Hador question with Rav Isi, because we have a passage in the Gemara in Gittin. The Gemara in Gittin says, you're not allowed to ransom captives for more than the going rate on the slave market. Why? So there are two reasons why. Number one, it costs the community a lot of money, but number two, it's going to lead to them taking more captives. So you're not allowed to expose the community to that kind of risk. But then it brings a story in which one of the sages ransomed Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha for a very high price. So how is that justified? And the answer that's given in Tosfot there, I brought it for you in number 40, is that where there is a threat to a person's life, that's a different story. Then you will charge, you will pay more. But more than that, it was because of Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha's unique trait as somebody who had value to the community in terms of his superlative wisdom. So that becomes a very important point, this idea of prioritizing based on communal need. In practice, when it comes to future family need, take a look at source number 41. Dr. Avram Steinberg says, if you're talking about donating kidney to somebody who is a stranger, I'm not talking about a donor chain right now, where that could actually end up leading to a reciprocal donation, but you're just going to give a kidney to somebody who is not a relative, he says you first should ascertain that the family of the donor does not include somebody with kidney disease or genetic disorders that could lead to them needing a kidney. He wants you to check first regarding the need within the family. That's his stance. He prioritized family first. And number two, in terms of communal need, I brought you a couple of sources on this from an IDF situation. The issue of ransoming soldiers who are being held captive and these terrible exchanges of 1,000 lives for 1,000, you're going to give 1,000 terrorists over in order to free one soldier or the body of a soldier. So there, Rabbi Chaim David Alevi wrote decades ago in source number 42, that there is reason to engage in these kinds of exchanges. Because the soldiers, in order to have proper morale, need to know that we're going to do whatever we can to save them. And that's a point that weighs very heavily in these decisions. And Dr. Steve Jackson, who actually was originally from Toronto and moved to Israel and wrote a very good article on being a battlefield medic, noted as well, the medic has to endanger himself going out on the battlefield in order to retrieve people who are wounded or to treat people who are wounded. What's the justification for doing so? So one of the points he raises here, an additional consideration obligating a doctor to endanger himself ties into the issue of morale. This is intangible, but it has a strong intangible effect on the outcome of the battle. It is part of the delicate, complex fabric that can prevent or hasten victory for the fighting forces, dot, dot, dot. You can see it there. And so the point that he makes, which I think is very important, is, in this case, the good of the nation may rest on the medic endangering himself for the sake of the soldiers, because the soldiers need to know that that's being done on their behalf. And my argument is to apply the same logic here to say that in the event that you have somebody for whom you could donate who is of higher value to the community, like the soldiers are in this situation, there is justification to say that that person ought to come first, because that becomes the need of the community. These are all case by case. You know that they're case by case. But that's, I think, an important point to take into consideration in the consultation process. I'm going to close with one note, which I said more on Wednesday night, but I just want to capture it here briefly, which is we started out by presenting this as the life of the donor, or the needs of the donor, versus the needs of the recipient. That's a very stark black and white type of thing. The reality is that for a person to know I could have saved somebody's life and I didn't can be a very painful thing, versus the feeling that comes from actually having done it, from having given that kidney in order to help somebody else. The Torah presents V'lo samod al dam reyecha, don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed, as part of the perek that begins Kedoshim Tehiyu, that you shall be holy, and includes laws like don't steal, don't lie, don't cheat. If you want to be a person of Kedusha, if you want to be a person of holiness, this is what you have to do, including don't stand by while somebody else is going to be hurt. So that it's not really a matter of my need versus their need. It's my need versus my need. It's about who I am going to be. And that really shouldn't be lost in this calculation. Even if it's vague and amorphous, it still should not be lost in this calculation. There's more to see. You can look at the paragraph I brought you in number 44. But I think that's an important point to consider in this. Thank you very much. And I do hope to schedule a session at some point to talk about the second part of this, which we really did not have a chance to get to. And I'm going to stay for people who have questions and want to discuss things further.
I just wanted to tell everybody who